May it please the court. My name is Scott Thompson, and I represent Edward Hughes. To grant relief in this case, the court must consider two broad issues. First, the boundaries of searches incident to arrest. Second, when the court recognized those particular boundaries. By way of background, the Fourth Amendment, of course, guarantees the right of the people to be secure from unreasonable searches and seizures. Pursuant to this constitutional guarantee, warrantless searches and seizures are deemed per se unreasonable, subject only to a few specifically established and well-delineated exceptions. This case concerns one of those exceptions. Incident to arrest, officers may lawfully search the arrestee's person and the area within his immediate control, meaning the area from which he might gain possession of a weapon or destructible evidence. But once that personal property of the arrestee is within the exclusive control of the police, the exception no longer applies. Despite the clear directives of Keimel and Chadwick, decades later, we are still debating when something is within an arrestee's reach or immediate control. In Gantt, the U.S. Supreme Court clarified in the context of a vehicle search, that the space searched incident to arrest is only that space within the arrestee's immediate control. In that case, the court sought to rein in its previous holding from New York versus Belton, which holding effectively led to wholesale searches of cars whenever an occupant of the car was arrested. And Gantt did so by limiting searches of vehicles to evidence of the offense of the arrest. But Gantt also reiterated, in all contexts, vehicles or otherwise, that a search incident to arrest must only be that space or area within the arrestee's immediate control. Edward's case is like Gantt in that it involves a vehicle search after Edward was placed under arrest. Edward was removed from the car, placed in handcuffs, and his clothing was searched. Nevertheless, officers searched the car and retrieved Edward's bag despite an arrest for merely a bench warrant. Now, even if this court were to countenance the search of the car and the retrieval, the seizure of the nylon bag as somehow not violating Gantt, the subsequent search of the bag was still illegal under Gantt. As I mentioned, Gantt involves more than, or is broader than just searches of vehicles. Not long ago, this court decided State versus Carawell. The court noted Gantt's ruling that searches incident to arrest had to be strictly confined to areas and things within the immediate control of the arrestee at the time of the search, whether a vehicle was involved or not. This court concluded in Carawell's case that the bag that he was seen holding that was forcibly removed from him by the officers, that the search of it was unlawful because it was not incident to arrest. It was not incident to arrest, according to this court, because the bag was not within his immediate control when it was searched. And the court said its decision was based firmly on the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Arizona versus Gantt. And the court wrote, and I'm paraphrasing here, that police may lawfully search a vehicle incident to arrest in two situations. One, if the arrestee is within reaching distance of the passenger compartment at the time of the search, or two, it is reasonable to believe that the vehicle contains evidence of the offense of arrest. And the court wrote that that first category of searches is just a reiteration of Keimel and Chadwick, the general rule that applies to all searches incident to arrest, whether vehicle or not. So our argument, of course, is that at the time of Edward's arrest, it was some 6 years, I think, after Gantt had been decided.
I think they argue here that the bag was still within the reaching distance. Is that right?
Not at the time of the search. They said it, well, it's interesting. The respondent did say that it was in the proximity of Mr. Hughes when it was searched, but that was only so because Officer Steckfuss, who took the bag from the car, brought it over to Mr. Hughes.
And Mr. Hughes was handcuffed at this point.
He was.
Am I correct that Gantt said the police, quote, may search a vehicle incident to a recent occupant's arrest only when the arrestee is unsecured and within reaching distance of the passenger compartment at the time of the search?
Yes.
And so he was secured in this instance?
He was secured. And that's what, in Carawell's case, made the search not a search incident to arrest, because Mr. Carawell was handcuffed, I think actually in a police car, when the officers chose to search the bag. And it would be, ridiculous to assume that officers can get around the Fourth Amendment's prohibition on unreasonable search and seizure by the expedient of taking a bag or a backpack or a purse and bringing it over next to the person of the arrestee. And again, the rationale of Carawell.
In this case, there was an active bench warrant for Mr. Hughes. Is that right? And so, and he was a passenger.
He was.
And so, isn't there some thought that he being removed with his stuff, that the driver may just peaceably go on?
Well, indeed, I think that's what happened. That he was.
You don't have to impute any sort of poor motive to this officer to separate the person who had the warrant out for his arrest and his stuff and get them outside the vehicle and let the other person go on?
Well, it's of course, the bedrock of our claim is that the actual search of the bag was illegal. Mm-hmm. But, I think the circumstances of this arrest and this situation, coming as it did so long after the Gantt decision, should have at least given the officers pause as to whether or not they could legally and reasonably search that bag.
Our next case is not a vehicle search, but Gantt was, and clearly said that what I just quoted, that you can search only if the arrestee is unsecured and within reaching distance of the passenger compartment.
Correct.
So are you saying that a reasonable officer could not in good faith have thought they could search after Gantt?
I don't think so, not once the arrestee was secured.
Unless,
of course, the officer was searching for evidence of the offense of arrest.
The concern, I guess, is that, so if the officer didn't seize the bag, and that bag was indeed Mr. Hughes's bag, and let the driver go off with it, and the driver took the contents of the bag and it contained a bag of diamonds, for example, Mr. Hughes may have a claim against the police department for not securing his property from the car before they left. And then wouldn't the police, if they did that, inevitably discover the contents when they did a search, an inventory search?
Well, I don't think, if we are going to suggest that the police have an obligation for the benefit of the arrestee to seize everything in his or her vicinity, then I think we need to make some new exception to prohibition against searches.
In this case, the police officer asked Mr. Hughes if that was his bag, and he said it was.
The record shows he claimed.
So it is not a circumstance with them seizing everything within the vicinity. This was identified as his property.
It was identified as his property, but I still suggest that they took it out of the bag or they took it out of the car, and so in that respect, this case is Gantt-like.
Well, except for the fact that you're suggesting that this would be a new strategy if people arrested people, cuffed them, set them outside, and then went and put stuff beside them so that they could search. I mean, that's where I thought you started out.
Well, I think
in this case, there's an active warrant, And so nobody with an active warrant has any, you know, much privacy interest in what's on them when they get arrested. And he identifies the bag as him, and it's set outside the car with him. If it's within reach, why wouldn't it be reasonable to search it?
Because he was secured at the time of the search, just as Mr. Carrawell was secured at the time of his search. And I think...
How much time had elapsed between the time that the defendant identified the bag as his and it was placed near him and searched?
The record doesn't reflect if it was a period of seconds or minutes. The way it's narrated in the transcripts, it seems to be almost instantaneous that Mr. Hughes is taken out of the car and cuffed, and he's searched, and then the bag is, you know, seized from the car. You know, they say, the police officers, that it was where he had been sitting, and he did identify it as his bag. But I don't know that there was much time had elapsed.
What did they identify as their reason for the search? Were they concerned about it contained a bomb or a weapon, or was it because they thought anything they took with them? What did they say their reason was?
I don't know if
or what was argued below.
Certainly what was argued to the trial court was that this bag was somehow a personal effect.
But it wasn't a danger thing. It was a personal effect.
It was a personal effect thing. There was no danger articulated by either police officer nor concern about destructible evidence when they searched the bag. Mr. Hughes was already secured, and the circuit attorney said even well after Carrawell had been decided, still maintained that the search was legal as incident to arrest because these were personal effects. I see that I'm almost out of time.
In fact, when it blinks, you're over.
I'm sorry?
When it's blinking, that means you're over by that much.
Thank you.
No. We'll reserve you your full time for rebuttal.
May it please the court. The facts in this case don't show that this bag was moved from the car to a different location closer to the defendant. What the facts in this case show was that the defendant was arrested when he was standing next to the vehicle, and that the bag was right next to him when they asked him, "Is that your bag?" and they picked it up and then searched it.
Did the facts show whether the door was open or closed?
The evidence is not explicit as to whether the door of the vehicle was open or closed. There was no testimony that anybody closed the door, and the bag was apparently visible to the officers, and the officer testified that the bag was directly next to the defendant, and the defendant was standing next to the car.
And the defendant was handcuffed and not able to access the bag?
Well, I wouldn't agree with that. He was handcuffed, but one of the cases I cited in my brief, the Shakir case, which I believe is from the Third Circuit, talks about whether a defendant is secured, and the Perdomo case also, which is an Eighth Circuit case, talk about whether a defendant is secured adequately for purposes of a Gantt analysis when the defendant has been handcuffed, but the bag is still within the proximity or reach.
And was
the
bag within reach because the officer moved it there, took it out of the car, and put it next to him? Did it stay where it was in the car?
The only thing the officer said was that it was on the seat directly next to the defendant.
When he saw it, but because it sounded like from the prior argument that it had been taken out of the car and put.
Well, it was taken out of the car right when they asked him, "Is that your bag?" And at that time, the evidence shows the defendant was still standing next to the car. In fact, the officer said that the defendant was between the officer and the car. In other words, mm-hmm. The defendant had superior access to the car, but for the fact that he was handcuffed. But in terms of proximity, he was closer to the car than the officer was. And that's reflected in the transcript on page 19, where the officer said he was between me and the car.
What about the language I quoted from Gantt that says, "Police may search a vehicle incident to a recent occupant's arrest only when the arrestee is unsecured and within reaching distance of the passenger compartment at the time of the search"?
Right, and I agree that language is there. And the question then is, well, what does it mean to be secured? And the Shakir court, they looked at that question, and the defendant had made a similar argument in that case, that because he was handcuffed, he was secured as contemplated by Gant. The court characterized that argument as an aggressive reading of Gant and said, we don't read it that way. And we said, we understand Gant to stand for the proposition that police cannot search a location or item when there is no reasonable possibility that the suspect might gain access to it. In other words, that the suspect has been secured to an extent that they can't get access to it. Now,
that's not what Gant said, but is that a unique, or are there a lot of appellate court decisions that have so interpreted it?
I don't know that there are a lot of appellate court decisions have looked at that, because Gant hasn't been uniformly extended into these types of searches. The Perdomo case.
The vehicle searches? Seriously?
No, to searches of items. And I'm sorry if I misspoke. I meant to items that were taken. And if you look at the Shakir case, It was a situation similar to what we have here, but also another court that looked at this, Perdomo. There were two judges on a three-panel decision there who said the defendant wasn't sufficiently secure in that case to apply Gant to the search of the bag that occurred in that case, even though the defendant had been handcuffed and there were two officers present. A dissenting judge said, "Well, I think that Gant should apply." I think is what the dissent said in that case.
You know, one of the issues on which has caused confusion in this and prior cases is Gant doesn't make this distinction here between personal effects and other items, which you might seize and search. Some earlier Missouri cases do that. They seem to focus on whether they're secured and within reach. Can you address,
sure,
when Gant doesn't limit it to non-personal effects here, how could an officer in good faith think they could search?
I think there's a distinct difference between personal effects that are on the person of the arrestee and an area that is searched incident to arrest.
But does Gant make such a distinction?
I believe it does, because it talks about you can search a person or you can search an area within immediate control. And Gant specifically focused on an area within control because that was what was at issue in that case, which was a vehicle, not a personal effect. And the defendant in that case had driven up in his vehicle, parked, gotten out of the vehicle. The evidence in that case did show that he closed the door. And then an officer who was on the scene for other purposes said, "Hey, come on over here." And then they walked toward each other, and about 10 to 12 feet, maybe 10 to 15 feet away from the defendant's vehicle, the officer confronted the defendant, arrested him, secured him, and moved him away from the vehicle and made it so that he couldn't access that vehicle. And in that case, the court said that the vehicle was no longer an area that the officers could search because the defendant couldn't gain access to it. And so the twin rationales of Chimel, I'm not sure how to pronounce that,
either.
Sorry, they came into play in that case because it was an area that was being searched. If you look at, if you go back a further step and follow the court's jurisprudence back to the search incident arrest case Robinson, that case talks about the search of a person incident to arrest or the area within the person's control incident to arrest, and makes a distinction. When you're talking about an area, and then Chimel, I think,
and logically, why is there a distinction?
There's a distinction logically because the person of the arrestee and the personal effects that are on the person, immediately associated with the person, are subject to a full custodial arrest. And in Robinson, they said, when you're subject to a full custodial arrest, a search of the person is itself a reasonable search.
What is the significance of the fact that this was an item that was seized, and once the item was seized, there is no danger and there is no purpose for the search at that point, that Mr. Hughes didn't have access. So what justifies the law enforcement officers to open the bag and look inside the bag once they have seized the bag and it's not within his control?
Two things. I think that the fact that the officers had obtained control of the bag or exercised a degree of control over the bag is not a definitive fact in this case, because the defendant was still in close proximity to the bag. And courts have recognized, in the Shakir case, Perdomo case, those are cases that recognize even when somebody's handcuffed, they might be able to struggle.
With two officers and the bag's in one officer's control.
Yep. And you know what? I've had, well, the Carowell case, I think, was a case where three officers had to subdue the defendant who was resisting arrest. And people can become combative.
Well, do they automatically get to seize this bag just because it belongs to him? So if I'm in a car and I have suitcases there and they arrest me for an unrelated matter, why do they get to seize my bags?
I don't know they automatically get to seize bags. But this case, I think, presents a situation where that was an area within the defendant's control. Immediate control, because he was still standing next to the vehicle.
But if we take that concept and extrapolate it, I mean, then couldn't the police search the contents of a phone because it was in close proximity?
Well, because Riley versus California talked about, they could search a phone, do a physical search of the phone,
but not
to see if there's something in the phone that could be, you know, dangerous or something like that. But Riley versus California specifically carved out data inside of the phone and said, we're not going to extend Robinson's search incident to arrest to the data that's inside of the phone. But they specifically held that the phone itself could be physically searched.
So they could hear, because they held him and handcuffed him and left him next to the car, that gave them the right to search what was in the car, whereas if they moved him over 2 feet, they wouldn't have.
Well, I guess in a sense, yes. But I don't think 2 feet would have made the difference, because a person who's handcuffed can struggle and move 2 feet.
Must be a really big jumper.
Well, two feet. I think that a person who's struggling, they could easily move 2 feet to a place where their bag is. They might even be able to get their hands on
it. But you understand my point, and for us, for making a rule, how do we take into account the concern expressed by opposing counsel that the police have within their control to make something within the passenger's reaching distance by moving the passenger around or choosing not to move the passenger around? Does it make sense that the constitutional rule would depend on those kind of vagaries?
Well, I think that, you know, there could be situations that would arise where reviewing courts would look at it and say, well, that's absurd. Why did the officer go through, you know, all of those efforts to put the bag or the item or whatever it is back into the area of control of somebody who'd been arrested? In which case, I think that the touchstone of the Fourth Amendment would kick in and would say, you know, people have the right to be free, you know, protected against unreasonable searches and seizures. And so we would look at the reasonableness of the officer's conduct in carrying out the arrest and the search incident to arrest. And, you know, without requiring necessarily a certain checklist of actions in every case as to timing or the manner in which something occurs. In this case, for instance, you have two officers at the scene. You have three people inside of the vehicle. The bag is in the back seat, where the defendant, even though he's handcuffed, might be able to get away and get a hand on that bag, or one of the two people in the vehicle, if they happen to be co-actors acting together with this defendant in some sort of enterprise, or if they feel some reason to try and protect the defendant for whatever reason, they could reach back and get that bag.
No safety claim here. It was just personal effect.
You're correct. Nobody argued or said that there was that. But the question isn't whether the officers had a subjective belief that they needed to protect themselves or that they needed to preserve evidence. The question is whether there's an objective basis in the evidence for the twin rationales of Schimel to come into play. And any time you have a situation where there are multiple people on the scene who, in this case, happen to outnumber the officers who are on the scene.
But weren't the other persons in the car still in the car?
They were.
So really?
Close to the bag. One of them could have easily.
But the bag was outside the car by this point.
Well, only after the officers removed it.
Right.
And so the point is that it would have been unsafe to leave it there.
But if you were concerned about the other people in the car, they didn't search them for safety, so that doesn't really make sense in this situation.
They didn't need to, apparently. They felt they didn't need to, because if there was, they were checking them out as well, and they didn't find anything that led them.
I understand your rationale, but saying here, because people in the car might have been near the bag, they were worried they might grab something from the bag, but they weren't worried enough to make sure the people didn't have weapons on their person. Is that a reasonable reason?
That goes again to the subjective actions of the officers and their thought processes. And the question is it reasonable to remove that bag? And it is objectively reasonable when there are other actors on the scene who could take control of that bag and harm the officers if there's a weapon in there, if they're so inclined to do so. Now, the officers...
Now, what case says that? What case says it's dependent on the other people or other actors that may be in the area. All the cases that you've cited and talked about that have expanded the search of the person from the person to the glove compartment to the trunk at one time and then back in the cases have all talked about the safety of the officer and the individual being arrested, not the other individuals on the scene.
No, but the safety of the officer is and can be affected by other people on the scene.
What case talks about that?
There is a case, and I apologize, Your Honor, I'm not bringing it to mind right away, but it talks about how the presence of co-actors or potential co-actors at the scene could present a danger to the officers. And one moment.
This was not a case of where there were several individuals involved in a crime that had been reported or that type of thing.
That's
this
correct.
This was picked up on a bench warrant.
That's correct. It's not. But I think that law enforcement officers have a lot of experience out there, and I think courts have seen over and over again that even something that appears to be a simple traffic stop can quickly escalate. And you just never know what might happen. Well, somebody might be, you know, they decide to be belligerent. You know, in Carowell, it very rapidly escalated. In this case, it didn't. I'm glad it didn't. But the fact is that these situations, anytime you have interactions between officers who are conducting an arrest, and if the defendant has potential co-actors or people who might come to his aid or defense, you have a situation that could become dangerous.
That would extend it from the person arrested and now all his personal effects anywhere within his reach, even if he's handcuffed, to everybody else in the car and their personal effects.
Well, potentially, depending on the circumstances and depending on the facts of the case, a trial court could look at that and say, do we need to do this? And I think that
you would need to articulate some basis for reasonable suspicion that there was something dangerous there, some reason why you needed to search or question those other individuals in the vehicle. And here, so if I'm driving in a car and I'm giving one of my kids' friends a lift, and if that person has a warrant, they could search everything in the car because you never know, we might come to that kid's aid, and therefore I lose all my privacy rights even though there's no reasonable suspicion.
No, I don't know that,
to me.
I don't know that you do lose all your privacy rights.
So you're saying it's a safety reason, but the safety reason only goes to his bag because I might grab a gun out of that bag, but not out of my bag. It's an objective reasonableness test, but I'm asking you objectively, how is that reasonable?
Right, and I'm talking about it in terms of the defendant's bag because that's what was seized. That's what was searched. And if we had to look at if the officers had gone beyond that and had done something else, we might have to look at the reasonableness of their actions in doing that. And I could imagine situations where it might not be reasonable for the officers to expand that search. But, for instance, when officers go to conduct a search warrant in a house, they can secure the scene. And they can remove everybody from the house. They can secure all the people so that the officers can conduct that search safely without fear of somebody in the house deciding that they want to act out and harm the officer.
He raised the issue of inevitable discovery because there would be an inventory search when Mr. Hughes was booked at the police station. Can you address that? I know you're over time.
Yes, I can. And in the ordinary course, and the officer testified to this effect at trial, an arrestee, once they're transported to the police station, all of their property will be packaged and placed into evidence as prisoner property and will be inventoried at that time for the traditional reasons to protect, you know, both the officer against false claims later and the defendant so that the defendant can be assured of receiving all of his property in return. And the officer testified that in the ordinary course, that's what would have happened to the defendant's property. This case presents a wrinkle, however, because the bag wasn't on his person when they took control of him. It was sitting in the car next to him. And so the question then arises.
Is this from Carowell, where he had it in his hand? They couldn't put the cuffs on until they took the bag out of his hand.
Well frankly, and I think, you know, in the court below, everybody argued and I should say, ultimately, I offered a secondary argument that if Carowell applies here, and frankly, there's a good argument to suggest that Carowell would apply, the rule that this court came up with in Carowell would apply in this case, then there isn't much that distinguishes it from Carawell. And so then the question becomes, should the evidence have been excluded? In Carawell, the evidence was not excluded. The search here took place in the same time period with the same reliance, good faith reliance, on pre-Carawell case law, and so the evidence in this case also should not
but
be excluded.
But how could you in good faith rely on pre-Carawell case law, in particular dealing with a vehicle search, when Gantt was so clear?
Well, two things.
I mean, you don't get to choose between the Missouri Court of Appeals and the U.S. Supreme Court.
Absolutely true, Your Honor, and two things. First of all, Gantt was not the basis for suppression below when it was argued. And the second—
Carawell cited and relied on Gantt, so relying on Carawell is relying on Gantt.
Carawell did, but Carawell, I think, is reasonably viewed as an extension of Gantt, an expansion of Gantt into a new category of cases. The fact is that there was a search of the vehicle in this case. I mean, the bag was in plain view there, apparently, but they did go into the vehicle to get it out. But another thing that distinguishes this from Gantt is that this defendant never asserted or established a reasonable expectation of privacy in the back seat area where this bag was taken. And before he can assert a Fourth Amendment claim as to that search, he has to have a reasonable expectation of privacy.
The Supreme Court has said when you're seized, when you're in a vehicle, even if you're a passenger, when you're seized, your privacy expectations are affected.
No, yes, because your body has been seized. And so anytime your body has been seized, you have a claim, a Fourth Amendment claim, because you have been seized. But when it comes to the search of an area, you have to have a reasonable expectation of privacy in that area. And Gantt, the defendant, did. It was his vehicle. He was the owner. He was the driver. He had just gotten out of the vehicle. Here, the defendant was a passenger in the back seat, and there was never a claim on the part of the defendant that he had a reasonable expectation of privacy in the place that was searched in the vehicle. The only claim of
privacy— It's the seizure of the bag that he's complaining about, and that was his, and he had a right in it.
That's correct, Your Honor. The only claim he made as to an expectation of privacy was in the contents of the bag, the container, and thus— for the court in ruling on the suppression issue and on the particular issue that was presented to it, I think had to rely on Carawell and not Gantt, because Gantt dealt with the search of a vehicle and whether that search of that vehicle was reasonable under the Fourth Amendment, and Carawell dealt with the search of a bag that was taken at the time of the arrest, and that's what occurred here. And I think that when you look at that, this case—
You really think Gantt did not control this case?
No, absolutely not, because the defendant had no reasonable expectation of privacy in the back seat of that vehicle.
No, you're addressing standing to raise it. You're saying Gantt did not govern what a reasonable officer could do.
It did not Gantt governs what a defendant, I guess what I should say is the defendant has to have a reasonable expectation of privacy before the Fourth Amendment comes into play. So even if Gantt is going to have controlling effect in this case, the defendant here can't rely on it because he can't assert the same expectation of privacy in the backseat of that vehicle that the defendant in Gantt was able to assert in his own vehicle.
Unless he said, I don't want it. Unless when he asked him if that was his bag, he said, yes, but I don't need it.
Well, actually, I don't think that affects the search of the vehicle at all. It might affect whether the officer should have seized the bag.
Right. Right.
Because, you know, and I think
do you agree with your opposing counsel that it was a relatively short period of time?
Yes.
Between the time what does the record reflect?
The record does not divulge how long it took, but the officer's testimony was fairly short. What he described, I think, seemed to be a short interaction there by the side of the vehicle, and I think that the trial court, more importantly, could have reasonably inferred that it was a short period of time and that all of these actions took place within, minutes.
Under the standard of review, we have to assume that that's what the
I
trial
believe that's correct, Your Honor. The trial court's ruling should be looked at, the facts should be looked at in the light most favorable to the trial court's ruling. And so, you know, when you look at that, I guess, you know, whether the door was open, how close the defendant was to the bag at the time it was seized, all of those facts, I think, have to be.
But there has to be a reasonable basis in the evidence for making those inferences.
That's correct. And I've cited them in my brief, but, you know, there's testimony that he was still in the immediate reach of that bag. The officer testified to that at the time that that this search and seizure of the bag occurred. He said that he was standing right next to the vehicle, and he said that the search of it occurred in the presence of the defendant.
And what's your best case that says they can go beyond seizing the bag for their safety, but they have a right to search it?
I would say that every single one of the cases that talk about a search incident to arrest would be my best case there, because they all allow a search of the items that are within the immediate reach control of the defendant.
Items such as purses and bags.
Yeah. And going back to the previous question, I apologize, Shakir is a case that talks about if there are co-actors, apparent co-actors, then that is a circumstance that the officers can take into account.
How big is this particular nylon bag?
Pardon me?
How big is this particular nylon bag?
It wasn't described. It was described as a black Nike nylon bag.
Nike?
Nike.
Okay. Thank you. You're way over time. Thank you for indulging our questions.
Thank you.
Mr. Thompson.
Thank you.
Mr. Thompson, before, I want to make sure we address this, so I'm going to ask this right off the bat here. In your request for relief, you ask that we reverse all of the convictions and claim that the state can't establish what drugs came from what. You don't contend that the heroin that was recovered from Mr. Hughes's pocket was in fact a legal search, is that correct?
I agree that the search of his pocket was lawful as a reasonable search incident to arrest.
And wasn't there testimony from the arresting officer during the suppression hearing or during the bench trial that he believed that the narcotics that was pulled from the pocket of Mr. Hughes was heroin, and that the narcotics that were pulled from the nylon bag contained cocaine and heroin?
I don't know that the officer Murphy testified that way, but I will defer to the record.
There's a question whether you preserved your second claim of error, and that was that there was not a sufficient chain of custody for admission of the drugs. But there was no objection, and the exhibit was offered into evidence without objection and accepted. So in fact, it was in evidence.
Well, there was that was, I think, a failing on the part of trial counsel. I mean, absent perhaps trial counsel thought that that later the state was going to cure this, but I mean, they did offer it, the contents of the bag, the contents of his pocket, into evidence without objection. I would only say that this was, you know, a bench trial, and certainly before the conclusion of the evidence, while the court was still weighing the legality of the search and whether to admit this evidence, counsel did register an objection that the state hasn't even proven which evidence was the subject of an illegal
search. A lack of chain of custody goes to whether or not the evidence is admissible, and the evidence was already in evidence.
Was it admitted as evidence found in his pocket, or was it just admitted as something that was found during that particular search and arrest, and there was still, you needed evidence that it was not the allegedly illegally seized items?
Well, I think in view of the fact of Officer Murphy's confusion, it was admitted at the narcotics were admitted as something seized in this during this whole episode.
Did he testify that the bag from the lab contained both matters seized from the person and seized from the bag?
I don't recall. I there was this question during trial about Officer Murphy confessed that he only searched the Mr. Edwards' pockets. The other officer on the scene searched the bag. I just want to say, I'm out of time.
Okay. But did you include these objections in your motion to suppress?
In the motion, objections to the
chain of custody and
chain of custody, no. And my opponent did bring that up, but I would say that would require some incredible foresight on the part of trial counsel.
Well, it doesn't require foresight to object that there's a lack of foundation. And those foundational objections are routinely waived because they're not timely raised at the trial court. Whether it's a jury trial or a bench trial, the rules of evidence still apply, and counsel often get relaxed and waive foundational objections that they know can be cured, but you ought not to be able after the fact to say, well, that evidence came in without a foundation.
Well, Judge, Judge Russell's question was it included in the motion for new trial in advance, motion to suppress evidence in advance of the trial, and I would concede that it was not, but I would say at that juncture, counsel could not have predicted, the state was announcing ready, counsel could not have predicted that the state could not prove so fundamental a thing as where the evidence had come from.
Counsel did make an oral, included it at the suppression hearing as an oral motion to suppress, is that right?
She did, Your Honor, and it was this thing that's sort of peculiar maybe to the circuit court for the city of St. Louis, that it was a bench trial and also slash motion to suppress the evidence.
The record might be cleaner if it was in two processes, but the standard of review on appeal is even if they're not tried together, the evidence is considered at the suppression hearing and the trial for purposes of determining whether the motion to suppress was properly sustained or overruled. So for practical purposes, if you agree to try them together, counsel necessarily understands that if there's a foundation objection, they have to timely make it.
Right, and put lipstick on a pig, as it were. I mean, counsel did not object at the point that these narcotics were admitted into evidence.
Once it was admitted, is that the whole ball game from your client's point of view? Then it doesn't really matter what was found in the pocket and what was in the bag, because something was in his pocket and it was all there. Or did the state have to prove which particular item was found where and why?
I can't cite a case, but I can say I think that the tie goes to the citizen and not the state. I mean, if there is an illegality that affects the search and seizure of the evidence, and
but it's not like one thing that was grabbed was flour, and we don't know if the flour was in his pocket or the heroin. We know it was either heroin or methamphetamine that was in his pocket. So does it matter which, or maybe it does? But I'm wondering on what.
I mean, I think it matters in the sense that the state ultimately could not prove where it had come from. I mean. I think, and I can't remember the case, but this court recently decided, at least in the context of a search warrant application, where there was a defect in the application, it affected the entirety of the subsequent search. And I would, and it may be a stretch, but I would analogize this situation to that.
But you don't have to admit the drugs to prove that the drug is a drug or heroin or cocaine. You could, if there's no objection or there's no dispute as to whether or not this was heroin or not, there can just be testimony to support that. Couldn't there be?
Well, I mean, sure, there can be testimony. I don't know if counsel can be forgiven perhaps for putting all her eggs in the suppression basket. And reckoning that at least half these drugs were going to be, and the paraphernalia were going to be suppressed because of the clear directive of Carawell. I mean, she could be forgiven for thinking so because here we've got a case where sort of double secured. I mean, we have an arrestee who is secured, and we have the evidence that is secured. And I would urge this court to resoundingly reject the sort of Jason Bourne argument that even if an arrestee is handcuffed, that nevertheless he or she still can, get out of those restraints and reach into that bag and destroy evidence or seize a weapon. So I urge the court to reverse. Yes, Judge Fisher.
Thank you, counsel. No, I was just going to say I appreciate the Jason Bourne reference in your argument. Thank you.